Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, world. This is the Global Media and Communication podcast series. I am Aswin Punathambekar, the director of the Center for Advanced Research in Global Communication.
This is Jing Wang, the senior research manager at CARC.
Our podcast is part of a multimodal project powered by CARG here at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania.
At CARG, we produce and promote critical, interdisciplinary, and multimodal research on global media and communication. We aim to bridge academic scholarship and public life, bringing the very best scholarship to bear on enduring global questions and pressing contemporary issues.
Hello and welcome to the Global Media and Communication podcast series. My name is Yuval Katz and I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. I am delighted to have Professor Herman Wasserman from the University of Cape Town with us today. His book, The Ethics of Engagement, Media, Conflict, and Democracy in Africa, was published in 2021 by Oxford University Press. Hello, Professor Wasserman, and welcome to the show. Just to start us off, can you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hello, and thank you very much for this invitation. It's good to be here. My name is Herman Wasserman. I am Professor of Media Studies at the University of Cape Town in South Africa.
All right, thank you. So let's just dive into the book. As a way of introduction, can you tell us a little bit about the history of this book? You've written a lot about media and social movements in Africa in the past. How would you situate this book within the trajectory of your work?
Yes, I think this book, for me, brings together different strands of my research. On the one hand, as you've mentioned, media and social movements, media and activism, issues around conflict, but also issues around media ethics and normative frameworks. So the book, I think, wants to take media and conflict and media and social movements in on the continent as a starting point to make broader arguments around media ethical frameworks and its appropriateness for the African context. Its immediate, I think, impetus was a project that I was involved with, Media, Conflict, and Democracy project in transitional democracies or new democracies that was led by Katrien Voltmer. This book does not draw so much on that specific empirical data, but it draws on some of the arguments and some of the debates that we've had in that project. So that was really the stimulus also for this book. And then I tried to build on that.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that project? So what did you do in that project? What data were you collecting? And how that created the impetus to write this book?
Yeah, so that book or that project with Katrien Voltmer and colleagues was an international project that investigated the role of media in conflicts that accompany and follow transitions from authoritarian rule to more democratic forms of government. And we looked at four countries: Egypt, Kenya, South Africa. These are sort of African countries, and then also Serbia as a European example. And so this was a sort of a large comparative project. And that, again, also built on previous research that I have done with Katrien around issues of new democracies and transitions and how media helps shape those transitions, but also in turn are shaped themselves by those democratic transitions.
Okay. Really interesting. Thank you. So the book is written in a very specific historical moment and context, the fast democratization of many nations in sub-Saharan Africa in the 1990s and the relapse of some of these nations into authoritarianism in subsequent years. Can you speak a little bit about this particular context, or put differently, why was it crucial for you to write about the triad of democratization, conflict, and media in Africa at this particular moment?
Of course, I think, you know, there are constantly different moments upon which one could concentrate. And I think at this point, what I wanted to look at and wanted to maybe emphasize is the fact that democratization on the continent often takes sort of the shape of ebbs and flows. So it was really a way of also of writing against the notion of a teleological idea of democracy, that you have authoritarianism, Then there is this sort of liberal awakening, this third wave of democracy that occurred across the continent and elsewhere. And then, you know, miraculously, democracy arrives. We often hear that discourse in South Africa. We often speak about the miracle of 1994, for instance, you know, that there wasn't a civil war, etc. And that idea of authoritarianism that fits onto a neat line and a teleological line is something that I wanted to problematize. And so that's partly the reason why I also looked at these sort of lapses back into authoritarianism or authoritarian tendencies in the African context. I think, of course, that what we saw in the African context was in some ways maybe a harbinger for what then occurred more recently elsewhere in the world. I think we see, elsewhere in the world also sort of more returns to more authoritarian discourses, more populist politics. And I don't want to necessarily draw too straight a line between these different contexts. Even within the African context, there's lots of differences. But I think this idea that there's a democracy, even established democracies, that fit on a line and that never they will return to some sort of authoritarian context, I think is something that we have to guard against in our analysis. So it's a long answer, I think, but I mean, that's why I want to focus on this specific moment.
Yeah, no, I think this is a crucial intervention, and it's important for all of us to think about these things, especially in this moment of populism and authoritarianism across the world. This is also some things that I'm seeing in my research when I'm looking at Israel-Palestine, but also in Hungary, in the US, and it's really interesting and important, I feel, to think about these things comparatively. And I think this kind of moves us very naturally to the next questions, that your book focuses on English-speaking sub-Saharan African nations, and not individual nations in the continent like South Africa or Kenya, which you've written on extensively. And why did you choose this regional framework? Why is this regional framework helpful or useful? As you mentioned throughout the book, one of the challenges with many projects discussing politics in Africa is the fear of kind of reinforcing the stereotype of the miserable, violent continent, and which is the way it is often seen in the eyes of Western news consumers. And I'm wondering, don't you feel like that you might run the risk of playing into this stereotype by losing the nuance of the politics of a single nation? What kind of strategies do you employ to push back on these stereotypes of Africa throughout the book? And again, why was this kind of regional focus meaningful and useful in this project?
Yes, I think you touch on really valid points, and that is that, well, firstly, let me say it's partly a convenience in the sense that, you know, my work is largely focused on the Anglophone sphere. I know that most of the production, I think research production about the continent and the media, unfortunately, seems to be on Anglophone Africa. There's actually comparatively little on Francophone and certainly less on Lusophone Africa. And that has remained a gap for many years, and something that I think and hope colleagues that work on Francophone Africa would also contribute more, and that is also maybe a bit more recognition on the part of Anglophone African researchers of what's happening in Francophone. So I think there is a big ignorance among us that work in Anglophone Africa. So that's the first limitation that I would mention. I would say that there is, however, some logic in looking at Anglophone countries in the sense that they share a common experience of British colonialism. And so that legacy of British colonialism has also shaped the legacy of the media and often their ethical and normative frameworks that have often been drawn from those contexts, their media training programs, etc. So I think there is a logic in looking at them. But the book doesn't attempt a sort of strict comparative project. I mean, it's really taking examples from these contexts to make a broader argument. But you're completely right that there is the danger of saying, this is representative, or creating the impression that this is representative, which was not what I wanted to do. And there is certainly the need for more nuance and to always make the point that Africa is a huge continent with many differences, many different countries, different media systems, etc.
Yeah. I'm wondering, even though, as you mentioned, you use examples to illustrate your points, and you really don't don't talk comparatively, but I'm wondering, throughout your research, have you seen a type of flow between different nations that has contributed to a process of democratization, or the way that influence the way that media contributes to processes of democratization? And do you have any kind of example in mind that kind of reflects this kind of regional flow within Anglophone Africa?
Yes, I think South Africa and Kenya, for instance, are two examples. I mean, they're also examples that are countries that I happen to have studied and worked on more than some others. I think what makes them both sort of mutually maybe reinforcing is that both of them have quite strong democratic systems. They have very vibrant media, technologically quite advanced media systems. So in that sense, quite active online citizens, quite an active political discourse online in Kenya and South Africa. So those sort of comparisons similarities, I think, make them good examples to group together when we want to look at how media use and engagement with the media take place in African democracies. There, of course, then other countries like Zimbabwe, which is very close to South Africa, geographically speaking, and within the southern region, but that has a very different sort of political system and media system, and has suffered more from sort of repressive political regimes.
So I want to move from here to what I think is one of the most interesting interventions, theoretical interventions that you're making in the book, and which is kind of counterintuitive, and I would be very glad if we can kind of unpack it and talk about it a little bit. So one of the central interventions that you make on the book is reconfiguring conflict as constructive rather than necessarily destructive force in processes of democratization. And you draw from Chantal Mouffe's idea of agonistic democracy to make this point and criticize the Habermasian perception of a public sphere, arguing against this kind of totalizing logic or the kind of this idea that we need to reach a consensus as a pathway for a thriving democracy. So can you break down these ideas a little bit for our listeners? What is agonistic democracy? What is the difference between agonism and antagonism according to Mouffe? And how do you understand it? And how do you implement that in your work? And how does agonism challenge Western perception of what democracy should do as advanced by Habermas and others? And can you give us some examples from your research on media in Africa that illustrate how agonism is practiced?
Okay, obviously these are really complex ideas, and Chantal Mouffe's work is also, you know, very challenging and complex and very insightful. So I'm not going to try and summarize her arguments, but maybe in the way that I understand its applicability to this context, is also partly an attempt, and why I draw on that is partly, again, an attempt to write back or against the idea, the teleological narrative, in which African democracies and African media's role in democracies are often assessed, in the sense that you have typically the picture is there's a conflict, there's a civil war or something, there's polarization, then there's a movement towards democratization, media liberalization in the 90s, etc. And then again, you have a more or less a consensual democracy where conflict then is largely absent, where you have peaceful elections and so on. So very much a sort of procedural idea also of democracy and the media. Whereas I think Chantal Mouffe's work helps us to understand conflict as something that is always inherently there, in that you, of course, can have violent conflicts that nobody wants and that we would try to avoid. But I think the idea is that if you see conflict as a sort of characteristic of a healthy democracy, if that is harnessed correctly and if it is managed correctly, then it can be productive. So the idea between, the difference between antagonism and agonism basically is that the terms of engagement. You know, what are the terms through which people engage? Different parties, different movements, different political stakeholders. One is, the idea of antagonism, where people engage as enemies, right? So they try to really destroy each other. It's a zero sum game. It's I win or you win. Whereas the idea of agonism is more of an adversarial one, where people have strong differences of opinion, also mediated through journalism and other forms of media, but that it is that there is also a focus on how people can try and solve that, how those conflicts can lead to outcomes that are hopefully mutually acceptable. And in that sense, I think, you know, eventually in the book, I moved towards a sort of ethical framework of listening, which in some ways, I think also resonate with more recent movements such as constructive journalism or solutions journalism, where the idea is that journalism's role is also not to merely pit these enemies against each other and see politics as a sort of boxing match where one person will win, one competitor will be victorious, but where politics is rather a sort of really robust conversation and argument, but where people have the same common goal, and that is flourishing of society. So I think it's a different perspective of looking at it, and where it comes up against the Habermasian ideal is that, and maybe some examples from the South African context is, the idea that protest and social activism is a sign that democracy is not working. You know, we have we've had in the post 1994 decades, we have had regular protests by citizens, and sometimes they have been met with repression from government or violent responses. But the fact that they are there, the fact that people feel they can protest, says something about, you know, their engagement. And then, you know, the question sometimes arises, why then isn't there a sort of more rational debate about this? Why isn't there sort of an exchange of opinions in the media? Why do people go into the streets and barricade streets and burn things? And that sometimes, I think, points to a failure of the media in the sense that people are playing into the media paradigm of protest. That media tend to highlight those sort of ways of political engagement because they lack the imagination of engaging in other ways, of listening more closely, of telling stories differently, etc. And then often the demand is made that people should not engage in those sort of, let's say, spectacular forms of protest. Or when there's a student movement, the students should rather sit down and talk rather than blockade campus so that teaching cannot happen. The point is that I think that all those sort of arguments come from a Habermasian idea of rationality as the cornerstone of democracy. Whereas I think people like Susan Bickford and others that I mentioned in my work on listening have actually told us that, or taught us that, when people feel strongly about something, they get emotional. And emotions are valid ways of engaging politically. In fact, they are often signs that people are really invested in a political project when they get emotional, when they protest, when they shout and when they scream and when they, you know, block roads. And we should try and use that as a trigger to engage with people and to listen to people and for the media to try and imagine what the solutions might be to the problem, rather than, again, pitting this as two camps in a sort of boxing match and that only one of them can win. So, I mean, again, it's a way, I think, of trying to write back to that idea also of that normative vision of African democracies also often as, there's a conflict, then there's a political process, a rational process, elections, multi-party democracy, and then there's peace. That is a sort of teleological narrative that I think is not really helpful in helping us understand these sort of ebbs of African democracy.
So I'm wondering if we're thinking about that in the context of what you just described, the importance of emotion and being emotionally invested. And I want to shift gears maybe a little bit to think about the media, which is, you know, the focus of your book. So how do you envision the media covering emotions as opposed to, you know, only talking about rational debate in the Habermasian sense? What is the role of media of, you know, making sure that this type of discourse is also included and is seen as a part of nation building or democratizing the nation and so on?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's much easier to think of these things in abstract terms than actually looking at them in practice. And that's the big challenge, I think, for us as researchers, is to find practical ways and to suggest practical ways for journalists to do this. But I think one way of doing this is for journalists really to commit to being surprised, to commit to having their frameworks upended. And also then practically that means that you also, I think, hand over almost the microphone or the whatever means of journalistic production to people outside of the newsroom. I think often journalists frame a story in a certain way. They already have an idea of who the actors are, who the opponents are, what the issues are, and then they just fill in the blanks. You know, they just sort of coloring within the sort of borders that they've already drawn. Whereas I think the commitment to listening for journalists would mean that you should be able to commit to a type of journalism that might mean that those boundaries will be redrawn, that your picture of the world might be radically changed. And, you know, that, in other words, that if you really listen to the actors in these conflicts, that you might be surprised. And so it's also a question of imagination. It is really a question of imagining yourself in the position of somebody else. Now, I think the problem in African context, and specifically I talk about my own one in South Africa, is that they're often marked by severe inequalities, so social and economic inequalities, apart from political polarizations. So we have political polarizations that often map onto ethnicities and certain ethnic histories that were also historically exploited by colonialism. So it's a complex picture. But I think just in terms of the economics of the media, the political economy of the media, is that these media in Africa often operate in highly unequal societies. So there's a conflation of journalists that conflate their audience, their market, if you want to use that word, and the public at large. So they tend to view politics, they tend to write politics and construct that narrative from the point of view of social elites, people that can access the media, people that have a certain narrative. And in that narrative, then all others become sort of bit players. They become almost like caricatures of some sort of story. And the challenge then, I think, for journalists is really to actively go across those borders. And sometimes those borders are drawn by ethnicity, by language, by poverty, and really to try and open up and create dialogue. And again, it's not the sort of facile idea of dialogue. It's just people sitting together and saying things that they've been saying all along and just saying that louder and louder. And the idea is really to try and redraw and rewrite that narrative. And in the African context or in context of high inequality, that would mean then, I think, going beyond those boundaries of your specific market, of your specific audience, and going to listen to people that might not naturally form part of your own sphere of influence, your own sources.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm wondering, because newspapers and news organizations are very much institutionalized, and as you said, they're very much a part of, you know, the social elites. Do you find that news organizations, institutionalized news organizations, are able to be agile enough or flexible enough to incorporate these new voices, or what kind of journalistic practices or institutional processes have to take place in order to be able to include these new voices? Or should we pay more attention to maybe grassroots organizations, citizen journalists? I'm wondering, like, institutionally, is that possible? Because news organizations often tend to be very elitistic.
Yeah, I mean, you're entirely right. And I think all of these debates that we're having, or this discussion that we're having, occur at a time when journalism is under severe pressure globally. Newsrooms are being cut back. I mean, there's an erosion of trust in journalism. Journalism has lost its sort of discursive power also in societies. And so journalists, it's very difficult for journalists to invest, or media organizations to invest, in long-term investigative journalism or embedded journalism in communities. So unfortunately, you know, the political economy of journalism, certainly in our country and elsewhere in Africa as well, militate against these sort of more creative and long-term imaginative ways of doing journalism. But I think for journalism to regain that trust and for journalism really to make a difference and to remain relevant, it would have to happen. It would have to, journalists will have to reimagine ways in which they work. And I think your suggestion about civil society and activists, I think that is a very useful one, because that can lead to partnerships and collaborations that just in terms of resources, you pool resources and you draw from other voices and other sources of information, and you have ears on the ground. But at the same time, I think it will also help to reestablish more trust in journalism, because now it's not only the social elites in their offices that write journalism, but also people that are actually on the ground and embedded in the ground. So to give you an example, for instance, around activism and protest in South Africa, I think I mentioned this in the book. Often, there's almost daily protests somewhere around something like what's been dubbed service delivery, which means that people demand water or sanitation or housing, all of these things that the democratic government has failed to provide to people. And then, when that protest happens, there's maybe a section of a big road that is barricaded. People are, burning tires and so on. It has become so commonplace then for journalists just to say, on the radio, for instance, avoid this road from this point to that point because there's a protest. If you want to go to work in the city, rather take this route, which tells you that the perspective on protest is that of a middle-class person wanting to get to the office and wanting to know what the traffic is going to be like. Not the question of, here we have a community. This is what the community is unhappy about. This is how long the community has been struggling to get water. This is how it affects their children, their health, etc. Those conversations only often enter journalism when it affects politics in parliament or voting behavior, etc. So again, a very sort of, I think, a sort of rationalized, maybe elitist way of thinking about politics as something that happens in parliament at the electoral process, at the ballot box. And not something that happens in the streets, and happens in communities. And that, again, I think, is the Habermasian idea of thinking about democracy. And certainly in the African context, where there's so much civil society, NGO, international funding going towards safeguarding things like elections and safeguarding things like multi-party democracy, which, of course, are all well and fine. But that means that, journalism and journalism's contribution to democracy is seen in a very narrow way of safeguarding those procedural aspects and those formal aspects, and not necessarily at voice, at listening, at communities and involving communities in journalistic production. So I think there has to be a paradigm shift, and that's not only going to be good for democracy, but also good for journalism.
Yeah, so this is fascinating, and I think that what you're kind of touching upon, which is something that you also discuss in the book. Again, I think really like this example that you presented about the middle class person who's trying to get to their office, and the reports on the radio just tell them how to avoid the protests and not really connecting with them or understanding communities' needs. So if we do have journalists who are invested in talking about these things, that kind of disrupts what we often see as the ideals of journalistic professionalism, right? So this sense of trying to be objective. If you have journalists who are and you discuss that in your book, if you have journalists who are coming from these communities that don't have access to water, for example, they cannot be objective. So can you talk a little bit about, these values, which are very often kind of Western values of what journalism should be, and how what you see in your research kind of disrupts that or challenges that?
Right. Yeah. And I think here again, the what is important to think about is how journalists are trained and educated, and what the sort of normative frameworks are, where they come from, often inherited from the West, and in the context that I write about, often from sort of Anglo-American sort of frameworks. And in those frameworks, I think something like objectivity, neutrality, balance, professionalism, that those sort of values are often prized and reiterated, the sort of training programs that are funded by international organizations for African journalists often reinforce those ideas. And so the idea of being emotionally invested, of being angry about things, about, you know, those are sort of values that are not necessarily often associated with journalism. So that's the one thing I think that that gives us sort of sometimes a sort of almost like cold view of what's happening in communities. It's a sort of very distant, objective way, which again, I think feeds into that idea of there are different stakeholders battling it out in a boxing ring. Somebody's going to win, you know, and we are the spectators. We on the journalists, we do the sort of match report in a way. So that's, I think, so one of the issues. The other issue is that of professionalism. And, you know, people have written about this. More people like Bobby Zelizer at your school, for instance, and others have written about the idea of the problem with professionalism as reinforcing a gap between social elites and communities. And I think that sort of gap is even more pronounced in highly unequal settings like South Africa and other places on the continent, where journalists are form of part of a social elite, trained in a certain way, having certain you know, lifestyle, maybe certain political agendas, and that maybe struggle, even if they want to. And this is not that they are necessarily want to be aloof or distanced, but this struggle to imagine themselves in the feet and the shoes of other people. So I think that the idea of professionalism is not necessarily a very helpful one when it comes to trying to do journalism differently. I think, of course, when we talk about professional values like truth telling, independence of vested interests and so on, then it is really important. And again, in the current context of disinformation and so on, those sort of values are important. But I think professionalism as a social status, as a social identity, is not necessarily very helpful. And I think, again, the journalism is a set of practices, and professionalism as a set of practices can be helpful, but when it becomes a social identity that actually counters people's engagement with other voices and other communities, I think it can become an obstacle.
Yeah. So I think this lends us very naturally into, I think, and you kind of mentioned that already in our conversation, this idea of listening and being more attuned to what the public needs and being more connected with local communities. So can you kind of break this down for us and maybe give us some examples of what that looks like? What does it mean for a journalist to listen to a community, to be more connected, to be more relevant, and to serve a community?
I mean, Sam, there are some examples, and some of these examples that I mentioned in the book go back to maybe some of the traditions of even something like public journalism, civic journalism in the US, those ideas of town hall meetings where people come and speak and listen. And that certainly is one sort of listening practice where journalists can call meetings and just go and listen to what communities have to say. But I think those are sort of often maybe difficult to arrange, not always necessarily successful. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think what is probably going to be more helpful is, again, if we go back to this idea of collaboration, of journalism as a set of collaborative practices, where journalists see themselves as curators, maybe as change makers, as facilitators, but not necessarily as the only voices. And that idea of giving voice to the voiceless, I think, is sometimes, it might be well-intentioned, but it, again, can reinforce that idea of we are the ones that are in a position, we journalists are in a position to give voice to others. People have voice. The poor have voice. Marginalized have voice. The question is, does somebody listen to them? Are these voices being heard? And in that sense, I think it's going to take a sort of imaginative, it's going to need an imaginative turn on the part of journalists to say that we are not able, we are limited in the way that we are maybe positioned socially, that the way that our resources, the resources that we have, and that we have to collaborate with others, and that we have to bring in activists, collaborate maybe with social movements and civil society. And that doesn't mean that they should be uncritical. I mean, I think they need to be, they still need to interrogate critically what these activists and these movements are doing. But as a way of getting more stories and more voices and more narratives into this sort of agonistic sphere, I think it would need breaking down those walls, those sort of walls between journalists' offices, you know, big media institutions, and what's happening on the ground in communities and in local struggles.
Yeah, so thank you. And I think that, so one of the other interesting things that you talk about, especially in relation to democratization and conflict in Africa, is this idea that journalists can also be a part of you know, peaceful transformation. And you use this really interesting term of the sacredness of life as kind of a central ethical value that journalists should promote in order to promote peace. Can you explain a little bit what that means and unpack what sacredness of life means and how it is being practiced by journalists or how it should be integrated into their professional practice?
Yeah, so that notion of sacredness of life is actually the whole idea of a proto-norm, something that has come out of our work on global media ethics. And I've worked with people like Cliff Christians and Stephen Ward and others in trying to find a way in which media ethics can apply globally in a globalized media world. And so what the idea, and I think the idea of sacredness of life as a protonorm is actually Clifford Christian's idea. And, you know, that is consists of ideas like or three sub-norms of human dignity, truth-telling, and non-malfeasance. So those are sort of values, I think, that are that we could say are universally true. I mean, that in most cultures, most contexts, people value life. And I think what if those are the sort of central ideas, so something like human dignity, for instance, if that is a central ethical norm for journalists, it would mean thinking about how to treat people with that dignity, to give them the opportunity to speak, to listen to them, to also put those struggles of the poor, for instance, on the agenda, to think about what the huge social inequality and poverty in countries such as South Africa does to people's human dignity, and that drives your journalistic practice. So as an ethical norm, I think the idea of sacredness of life and also that also then consists of something like truth-telling, I think those ideas can drive journalism in a way that really contributes to social change in ways that maybe is a bit more dynamic, it's a bit more open-ended, more participatory than the idea of a sort of just a sort of really rational, almost sometimes a stenography of what happens in societies that is not really that invested and committed to people's sort of everyday lives and their human dignity. So I think that's where that idea comes from, and I'm trying to think about, you know, in my work, how that idea, what that means, what that looks like in a country such as South Africa and other countries on the continent that where so many people are really poor and marginalized and on the fringes, on the margins of society, and often out of earshot of journalists. So if you think about something like sacredness of life or human dignity, it would really mean for journalists to take people seriously that might not otherwise be heard and might not otherwise form part of media discourses, media narratives.
Thank you. This is really, really interesting, really important. And I'm wondering if we can, so our conversation so far has been very theoretical, I feel, and really, really fascinating. And I'm trying to think a little bit more in kind of practical terms. So if we're thinking about journalists who want to do that work, who want to be more connected to communities and talk about impoverished communities and support them and so on, do you think that this is something that should happen kind of bottom up? So it means that, you know, we need to, journalists should be invested in these things and just go to these communities, or is that something that should happen institutionally? So editors should dictate specific rules or should change the norms institutionally within news organizations. So I'm wondering if that's kind of a top-down process or a bottom-up process or both. What do you think?
Mm. That's a good question. And again, I mean, I think you're completely right in the sense that these ideas are easier to think about in abstraction. And then when you think about that in practical terms, it often becomes very challenging, and especially when there's limited resources. But I think that is one way why this is important, one way of addressing this is through diversity of newsrooms. And I think that is why it is important to appoint journalists that come from different communities. I mean, one of the a few years ago, one of my PhD students, Jacinta Maweu, worked on Kenya, and she's Kenyan, and she looked at the role that ethnicity, for instance, played in newsrooms, and how ethnicity often frames stories that people would, that journalists would report on their, you know, what happens in their own communities. And you can say the same thing about race, for instance, in the South African context, you know, why it is important for newsrooms to be transformed. And you can say the same about language and religion and so on. So I think once a newsroom is made up of people that have different perspectives and different backgrounds and different experiences, that already, I think, is a huge step towards, hopefully enabling journalists to listen better. So that's the thing, I think it's top down thing that can happen, and that should happen. Other ways of doing this is maybe more a bottom up thing is for more collaborative projects where newspapers or news outlets can literally hand over the means of production, even temporarily, to communities. So for instance, there is a big student protest movement that happened in it was called Fees Must Fall, in my country, in my city, in my university, in fact, a few years ago. What one of the newspapers did is they had these student activists guest edit an issue of the newspaper. You know, that's really literally handing over the reins, the control, to others. That's quite a radical step, but you know, those sort of collaborations can then, from the bottom up, help change things. But you know, and through technology and through mobile phones that are really pervasive on the continent, there are all sorts of ways in which technology can also be harnessed to do this. I'm sure you know there's lots of more creative ways of thinking about this. But I think the first step is really through that commitment and through that idea of thinking differently about what journalists' social identities, and that journalists should also think of themselves as part of a broader network of people involved in a broader conversation, rather than as these sort of gatekeepers. Nico Carpentier, in fact, I think, has written about this, and then he says, you know, journalists should be gate openers, not gatekeepers. And I think that's quite a useful metaphor. It's saying, you know, traditionally, journalists have been thinking about their role as gatekeepers, as deciding what story should go into the news and what should be kept out, what is news, what is news values. And in fact, they can turn that around by saying, let's open the gate, let's bring more voices in, and let's lose control of the narrative, maybe. I am a bit wary that all of this can lead to a sense that I'm, or maybe a misunderstanding, that what I'm advocating is a sort of journalism that's not critical, or that's not does not play that monitorial watchdog role, and that's not what I mean at all. In fact, I think it's quite the opposite. So I think in authoritarian contexts, that watchdog role and that investigative role, that critical role is incredibly important. But it can be done better if you involve more people, more eyes, more people on the ground that can tell you, you know, how the government is failing in different communities, how the police, maybe there's police brutality in poorer areas that you don't see in more affluent suburbs. So these sort of practices can, in fact, I think, strengthen that watchdog role, can, in fact, broaden that monitorial outlook. So it's not a argument for a sort of soft touch, sort of touchy-feely type of journalism. In fact, I think quite the opposite.
No, I really love this idea of thinking about journalists as gate openers rather than gatekeepers, and being like a more inclusive. I'm wondering, and this is kind of partially because of the type of work that I do. We talk about media, and we kind of, we usually in our conversation here, we talked about journalism and the news media. And I'm wondering if in your work and in the African context, you're aware of other media forms like television dramas or autobiographical books or fan communities on social media or any other types of media forms that can also help drive forward processes of democratization and peace in conflicted communities. Have you encountered any, or have you spent some time thinking about other media forms as well?
Yeah, definitely. And I think here again, journalism, I see journalism as a set of practices and a set of values that can be shared much more widely than just professional journalists in inverted commas, you know, journalists that make a living out of journalism. And again, you know, other colleagues have written about this more extensively than I have. But for instance, in Kenya, there's this big community of Twitter users. They even use the hashtag KOT, Kenyans on Twitter. There's an interesting case that I'm not going to go into in too much detail now, but years ago when CNN reported on a visit of Barack Obama to Kenya and, you know, painted Kenya as a sort of hotbed of terrorism, that community sort of sprang into action, and often through irony and humor and satire, which are stocks in trade of publics in Africa for a long time, that goes back all the way to colonialism and in ways in which colonialism was subverted through jokes, etc. Through those sort of means, publics and users of social media or people on mobile phones that spread gossip and humor and jokes can often contribute to a sort of conversation, a democratic conversation that's much wider than sort of news media in the traditional sense. Documentary filmmaking as well has been really powerful in many areas of the continent, and you know, has the potential, I think, to harness people's imagination. I think all these online communities, forms of humor and satire, even through pop songs. My colleague Winston Mano has written an article a while back around how pop music in Zimbabwe has played the role of journalism, where formal journalism was under pressure and people were making veiled criticisms against the government in pop songs, in lyrics. So I think we do have to imagine journalism as a set of practices and values that is much wider than conventional news journalism. And again, it creates opportunities for collaboration once those gates are opened.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, and you know, also for me, I see in my work on Israel-Palestine that pop culture is becoming a really crucial space for rethinking the relationship between different communities and reimagining social change. And I want to take a step back as we kind of conclude our conversation and kind of keeping in mind our listeners, many of whom are, you know, early career scholars who are thinking about their first manuscripts and reading. Reading your book, I think you did an excellent job kind of making very clear what is your intervention and also making sure that you know, what you're writing about speaks to a very wide audience. So not strictly to people who are interested, let's say, in democratization in the African context, but also thinking people are thinking about democratization more widely speaking in other political contexts, or thinking about, you know, ethics of journalism and so on. So can you talk to us, tell us a little bit about, you know, when you construct your argument, or where when you write, what kind of tactics do you employ in order to make sure that, you know, your arguments or your writing speaks to a wide audience, and that your book can be marketable to a wide audience, and how that kind of configures into your conversation with publishers? If you can reflect a little bit about your writing process in that regard, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for the kind words. I think scholars from the Global South often have a more difficult task to make their voices heard in that sense, because I often use the example when I wrote a book on tabloids in South Africa, tabloid journalism. If somebody wrote a book on tabloid journalism in Britain, right, they can just call it tabloid journalism or digital journalism or whatever. But I also have to say tabloid journalism in South Africa or in Africa or in the global South. And then immediately you also run into those problems of now you're homogenizing, you're constructing a monolith and so on. But we are always, there's always the demand, you know, that that work in the global South is located and that, you know, almost the work elsewhere is almost locationless. And of course, that is part of the work of decolonizing the field, you know, that that I've also been involved with, and some and others have been trying to make those points that, you know, the knowledge production often assumes a sort of universalism on the part of the global North, whereas in the global South, we're always called upon to make that specificity. So partly, I think one of the things that I try to do in my writing, and I think that you have alluded to, and hopefully that's been successful, is that using specific contexts to enter broader debates. So for me, the situation of South Africa and Kenya are in this book, for instance, are entry points into broader discussions around media and democracy that hopefully will also resonate with other contexts where media are operating in context of populism or authoritarianism and so on, without necessarily claiming again to be universally applicable, but that you enter a broader conversation. And I think the same with ethics and so on, you know, that there's a danger, I think, for scholars in the global South to become so parochial and so focused on their own context that it remains only relevant or only reread by scholars that are already interested in those specific contexts. And it doesn't really speak back to the broader narratives and theories in the field. So there's the tendency, I think, for media theory to and communication theory more generally to be developed somewhere in the North and then applied in the South. And the South just provides the sort of examples and illustrations to prop up that theory. And I think the way to undo that and the way to turn that situation around is to really engage on a theoretical level from Southern viewpoints. And that's what I try to do with say, the idea of the ethics of listening, for instance, is to try and engage with ethics theory, but do that using examples from the South African and other contexts. So that would be my advice, I think, for scholars in the Global South, is to not be apologetic about their experiences and try to limit it and try to be and think that you only have to speak about this in sort of very parochial terms, you know, in area studies type of terms, but really engage with media and communication scholarship on a theoretical level from the perspectives of lived experiences in the South, instead of constantly trying to apply theories that have been developed elsewhere to your own context. And in that sense, I think in that way, you can also then not only hopefully contribute to the decolonization or de-Westernization of the field, but you can also position your research in a way that is then that resonates with debates elsewhere and that hopefully will be of interest to people, even if they're not interested in your specific geographical context in the first instance.
This is wonderful. And I mean, I think you almost kind of state kind of the mission statement that we have here in CARG to think about media and communication beyond the global North. And I really love your idea of, you know, talking from the South and almost not being apologetic to create this conversation and kind of create your own intervention and not always adhere to these kind of veteran theories like the public sphere by Habermas that are kind of imposed on you know, other contexts in the global South. And so I'm wondering if and again, because I'm kind of aware of our listeners and many of us are writing about the Global South, if you have any other advice to give to kind of young writers who are writing about the Global South, how they, you know, can make their case, especially when communicating with publishers. You mentioned this idea that we always have to provide context, which is, again, something that really resonates, I think, with all of us, that if you write about the U.S., you don't have to provide any context. But if you write about, I don't know, India or Israel-Palestine or South Africa, you need to provide ample context. How can you make yourself kind of appealing to publishers and to make your case compelling, if you have any advice based on your experience?
Yeah, I mean, for me, a lot of this has been in terms of personal relationships, you know, in the sense that it takes time. But if you attend conferences and you attend workshops and you speak to people, I mean, my experience has really not been that people are uninterested in the Global South. And now I think also in associations like the ICA and elsewhere, I mean, there's a real imperative, a real effort also to try and be more inclusive. So I think if junior scholars from the South just take that step and to engage and to participate, I think they will find that there's a lot of goodwill and a lot of interest, in fact. So my suggestion would be really to try and participate where you can. And, you know, start small. Start by offering to write a book review, you know, for a journal. And then have your readership in mind. And so maybe there is a book on media in Africa, for instance, and you want to write a review of that for journalism studies or whatever other major journal. You know, you write it in a way that can resonate with the readers of that specific journal, but that you also then start slowly by claiming your space and by entering into the conversation. And it is a long process. I mean, it's a difficult process. And I think often the cards are stacked against scholars in the South, just in terms of, again, the political economy of knowledge production. It costs a lot of money to attend these conferences. It's difficult, often just the practicalities of obtaining visas, all of these things that, you know, often scholars in the Global North never have to think about, a visa to attend a conference. But we have to think about that 6 months before the conference, you have to start applying. You know, and all of those things cost money, they cost time. So it is a hard and a very difficult way. But I think it is important to try and engage in those spaces. The other thing that I would say is that increasingly we are seeing some of this happening in Africa. And I think to build localized or regional networks of solidarity. So, for instance, we've had a few ICA in Africa conferences. We'll be hosting one again next year in Cape Town. The idea, hopefully, is that it will also be attended by scholars from the North to come and listen and to come and see what people in the South are doing. But it's a more friendly and more open and a more it's an easier space to get into. So I would encourage also junior scholars in local contexts in their own countries, maybe in their own regions, to start building those sort of networks, building communities, supporting each other, and in that way, building a critical mass that can help engage global scholarship. But it's really important, I think. And it's not only important for scholars from the Global South, and that's the point that I'm always trying to make. This is not about charity or even social justice. It's not about inclusion and diversity. It's about really doing better scholarship. I mean, you cannot, if you sit in North America or Europe, claim to know everything there is to know about how communication ethics works if you don't know what the context is in Asia or in Africa or in Latin America or the Middle East. So it is important for the field that these sort of conversations happen. So it's worth pursuing.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that's a wonderful kind of concluding note that if we want to be, you know, intellectually rigorous, this is not about charity. This is about, you know, if you're sitting in the Global North, you better know about what's happening in the Global South if you really want to understand social phenomena and not only concentrate on what's happening in the Global North. Thank you so much, Professor Wasserman, for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to our Global Media and Communication podcast. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out through our email, cargc@asc.upenn.edu, or follow us on Twitter.
Until next time.